Disc 5.
My father was a Swiss banker, Gabriel. I know him as a man, but I know next to nothing about his work. So tell me about him. Where shall I start? How about his age? You're 38? 37? Your father was 89. That's a rather large age difference. That's easy to explain. He was married to someone before my mother. She died of tuberculosis during the war. He and my mother met 10 years later. She was quite a gifted pianist. She could have played professionally, but my father wouldn't hear of it. Musicians were one step above exhibitionists, in his opinion. Sometimes I wonder what brought them together in the first place.
Was there children from the first marriage?
Anna shook her head.
And your mother's suicide?
I was the one who found her body. She hesitated for a moment, then said,
One never forgets something like that.
Afterward, my father told us she'd had a history of depression. I loved my mother dearly, Gabriel. We were extremely close. My mother did not suffer from depression. She wasn't taking any medication. She wasn't under the care of a psychiatrist. She was moody, she was temperamental, but she was not the kind of woman who commits suicide for no reason. Something or someone made her take her own life. Only my father knew what it was, and he kept it secret from us.
Did she leave a suicide note?
According to the inquest, there was no note, but I saw my father take something from her body that looked very much like a note. He never showed it to me, and apparently he never showed it to the police either.
And the death of your brother?
It happened a year later.
My father wanted him to go to work in the bank and carry on the family tradition, but Max wanted to race bicycles, and that's exactly what he did. Quite well, in fact. He was one of the best riders in Switzerland and a top European professional.
He was killed in an accident during the tour of Switzerland. My father was devastated, but at the same time I think he felt a certain vindication. It was as if Max had been punished for daring to contradict his wishes.
And you?
I was alone with him. The two people I loved most in the world were gone, and I was trapped with a man I loathed. I threw myself more deeply into violin. The arrangement seemed to suit both of us. As long as I was playing music, my father didn't have to pay any attention to me. He was free to do what he loved most.
Which was?
Making money, of course. He thought his wealth absolved him of his sins. He was such a fool. From the beginning of my career, people thought I played with such fire. They didn't realize that fire was fueled by hatred and pain.
Gabriel broached the next subject cautiously.
What do you know about your father's activities during the war?
Activities? That's an interesting word. What are you trying to imply by that?
I meant nothing by it. I just need to know whether there was something in your father's past that might have led to his murder.
My father was a banker in Switzerland during the Second World War.
Her voice had turned suddenly cold.
That doesn't automatically make him a monster. But, to be perfectly honest, I know virtually nothing about my father's activities during the war. It was not something he ever discussed with us.
Gabriel thought of information Emile Jacobi had given him in Lyon. Rolf's frequent trips to Nazi Germany. The rumors of Rolf's connection to important members of the Nazi hierarchy. Had Rolf really managed to keep all these things secret from his daughter? Gabriel decided to push it a little further, gently.
But you have your suspicions, don't you, Anna?
You'd have never taken me to Zurich if you didn't have suspicions about your father's past.
I only know one thing, Gabriel. My mother dug her own grave, climbed inside, and shot herself. It was a hateful, vengeful thing to do, and she did it for a reason.
Was he dying?
The bluntness of this final question seemed to take her by surprise, for she looked up suddenly as though prodded by a sharp object.
My father?
Gabriel nodded.
As a matter of fact, Gabriel, yes. My father was dying.
When the food was gone, Gabriel poured out the last of the wine and asked her about the provenance.
They're locked in the desk of my father's study.
I was afraid you were going to say that. Why do you want to see them?
I want to look at the chain of possession for each work. The provenance might tell us something about who took them and why your father was killed.
Or it might tell you nothing at all.
And remember one thing. My father purchased all those paintings legally. They belong to him, no matter what quirk you might find in the provenance.
I'd still like to see them.
I'll show you where they are.
No, you'll tell me where they are, and I'll get them and bring them back here. You can't come to Zurich now.
Why not?
Because it's not safe, which leads me to my next topic.
What's that?
Your recital in Venice.
I'm not cancelling it.
It's not safe for you to perform in public now.
I don't have a choice. If I don't keep this engagement, my career is over.
The people who killed your father have made it abundantly clear that they'll do anything to prevent us from finding their identity. That would include killing you, too.
Then you'll just have to make certain they don't succeed.
But I'm going to perform next week, and there's nothing you can do to stop me.
Columns of gunmetal cloud had appeared over the sea and started their advance inland. A chill wind rose and moaned in the ruins. Anna shivered in the abrupt cold and folded her arms beneath her breasts, her eyes on the approaching weather. Gabriel packed up the remains of their lunch, and in the gathering darkness they ambled down the hill, shadowed by the two silent watchers. When they reached the footpaths of the pine grove, it began to rain heavily.
"Too late," Anna shouted above the pounding. "We're caught."
She took him by the arm and led him to the shelter of a towering pine.
"We need to keep your bandages dry," she said,
a note of concern creeping into her voice. She dug a wrinkled nylon anorak from the pocket of the rucksack and held it over their heads, and there they huddled for the next 20 minutes like a pair of refugees, Rami's watchers standing silently on either side of them like andirons. While they waited for the weather to break, Anna told Gabriel the security codes for the villa and the location of the provenance in her father's files. When finally the rain moved off, Anna bound Gabriel's hands in the anorak, and they proceeded carefully down the wet track to the villa. At the front gate, Gabriel relinquished her into the custody of Rami and climbed into his car. As he drove away, he took one last look over his shoulder and saw Anna Rolf chasing Rami across the drive, shouting, "Bang, bang, Rami, you're dead!"
Chapter 23. Lisbon. Motzkin liked it in Lisbon. He'd done the glamour postings. He'd done London, he'd done Paris and Brussels. He'd spent a nail-biting year in Cairo, posing as a journalist from a newspaper in Ottawa. It was quiet in Lisbon these days, and that was fine with Motzkin. The odd surveillance job, a bit of liaison work, just enough to keep him from going stir-crazy. He had time for his books and his stamps, and for long siestas with his girl in the Alfama. He had just returned from her flat when the telephone on his desk rattled softly. Motzkin lifted the receiver and brought it cautiously to his ear. This was the time Ari Shamron usually chose to poke his head out of his foxhole and make life miserable for his katsas. But thankfully it wasn't Shamron, just the guard down in the lobby. It seemed there was a visitor, a man who knew Motzkin's name. Motzkin rang off and punched up the lobby surveillance camera on his computer monitor. The station regularly fielded walk-ins of all shapes and sizes. Usually a quick once-over could determine whether the person should be seen or frog-marched to the gate. As the image appeared on his screen, Motzkin murmured, "I'll be damned." Imagine the living legend walking into the embassy, looking like something the proverbial cat dragged in. Last Motzkin had heard, he was holed up in some English cottage with his paintings and his demons. "I'll be damned," he repeated as he clambered down the stairs. "Is it really you?" In the communications room, Motzkin established a secure link with Shamron's office at King Saul Boulevard in Tel Aviv. Then he closed the soundproof door and watched Gabriel through the glass. It was an unpleasant conversation, that much Motzkin could tell. But then there were few people inside the office who hadn't crossed swords with the old man at one time or another, and the battles between Shamron and the great Gabriel Allon were the stuff of office lore. 20 minutes later, when Gabriel slammed down the telephone and stepped out of the room, his face was ashen. "The old man is sending a report through in 30 minutes. I need a few things." Motzkin took Gabriel upstairs to the station and allowed him to shower and change into clean clothing. Then he arranged airline tickets and a car and gave him $2,000 from the petty cash box. By the time they returned to the communications room, the report was sliding off the secure fax machine. It had been compiled by research section at King Saul Boulevard and was based on information shared through standing agreements with British and French intelligence. The subject was a man named Christopher Keller. Gabriel scooped the pages from the tray, sat down at the table, and started to read. Born in London, the only son of two successful Harley Street physicians, Christopher Keller made it clear at an early age that he had no intention of following in the footsteps of his parents. Obsessed with history, especially military history, he wanted to become a soldier. His parents forbade him to enter the military, and he acceded to their wishes, at least for a time. He entered Cambridge and began reading history and Oriental languages. He was a brilliant student, but in his second year he grew restless, and one night vanished without a trace. A few days later, he surfaced at his father's Kensington home, hair cut to the scalp, dressed in an olive drab uniform. Keller had enlisted in the British Army. After basic training, he joined his infantry regiment, but his intellect, physical prowess, and lone wolf attitude quickly set him apart from his peers. Soon a recruiter from the Special Air Service came knocking. He had seen Keller's file and spoken to his superiors. Keller was invited to the regiment's headquarters at Hereford to undergo the initial training course. His performance was extraordinary. The instructors in the unarmed combat course wrote that they had never seen a man who possessed such an instinctual knack for the taking of human life. In the Killing House, an infamous facility where recruits practice close-quarters combat, hostage rescue, and anti-terrorist room-clearing drills, Keller achieved the highest possible scores. On the final day of the course, he carried a 55-pound rucksack and 10-pound assault rifle during a 40-mile march across the windswept moorland known as Brecon Beacons, an endurance test that had left men dead. Keller completed the course 30 minutes faster than any man had ever done it before. He was accepted into the regiment and assigned to a Sabre squadron, specializing in mobile desert warfare. Then the course of his career took an abrupt turn. Another man appeared on the scene, this time from military intelligence. He was looking for a unique brand of soldier capable of performing close observation and other special operations in Northern Ireland. He said he was impressed by Keller's linguistic skills and his ability to improvise and think on his feet. Was Keller interested? That night he packed his kit and moved from Hereford to a secret base in the Scottish Highlands. During his training, Keller displayed a remarkable gift. For years, British security and intelligence forces had struggled with the myriad of accents in Northern Ireland. In Ulster, the opposing communities could identify each other by the sound of a voice. The accent of Catholic West Belfast is different from that of Protestant West Belfast. The accent of the Upper Falls Road is different from that of the Lower Falls. The way a man uttered a few simple phrases could mean the difference between life and an appalling death. Keller developed the ability to mimic the intonations perfectly. He could even shift accents at a moment's notice. A Catholic from Armagh one minute, a Protestant from Belfast Shankill Road the next, then a Catholic from the Ballymurphy housing estates. He operated in Belfast for more than a year, tracking members of the IRA, picking up bits of useful gossip from the surrounding community. He worked alone, with almost no supervision from his case officer at military intelligence. His assignment in Northern Ireland came to an abrupt end one night, when he was kidnapped in West Belfast and driven to a remote farmhouse in County Armagh. There he was accused of being a British spy. Keller knew the situation was hopeless, so he decided to fight his way out. By the time he left the farmhouse, four hardened terrorists from the Provisional Irish Republican Army were dead. Two had been virtually cut to pieces. Keller returned to Hereford for a long rest. He took punishing hikes on the Brecon Beacons and trained new recruits in the art of silent killing. But it was clear to the regiment's commanders and psychologists that Belfast had changed Keller. Then in August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. 5 months later, Keller and his unit were roaming the western desert of Iraq, searching out and destroying the Scud missile launchers that were raining terror on Tel Aviv. On the night of January the 28th, Keller and his team located a launcher in the desert, 100 miles northwest of Baghdad. He passed along the coordinates to his commanders in Saudi Arabia. 90 minutes later, a formation of coalition fighter bombers streaked low over the desert. But in a disastrous case of friendly fire, they attacked the SAS squadron instead of the Scud site. British officials concluded that the entire unit was lost, though no conclusive remains were ever found. What came next was essentially a theory, again based on intelligence reports. Some months after the disaster in the Iraqi desert, a new and highly professional killer was reported to be working in Europe. Police informants spoke of a man known only as the Englishman. None could offer more than the vaguest descriptions of him. To date, the mysterious assassin was a suspect in at least 20 unsolved murders. British intelligence suspected that Christopher Keller and the Englishman were the same man. The file concluded with two photographs. The first was the one Gabriel had taken of the man entering the gallery in Paris. The second showed a group of men on a deserted moorland. One of the faces was circled. Gabriel spent a long time comparing the two pictures. Then he picked up the telephone and called Shamron in Tel Aviv. "I have the strangest sensation I've actually met this man before," Gabriel told him. He had expected Shamron to be surprised by the remark. Instead, the old man told him to stay near the fax machine, and then he rang off. In 1988, Gabriel Allon carried out one of the most celebrated operations in the history of Israeli intelligence, the assassination of the PLO's second-in-command, Abu Jihad. He had conducted a long and dangerous surveillance operation on the Palestinians' villa in Tunis, and he had trained the hit team at a mock-up in the Negev desert. Then, one warm night in April, he led a team of the Sayaret commandos into the house and shot Abu Jihad to death in front of his wife and children. Thinking about that night now, he could still see the look of pure hatred in their dark eyes. 18 months after the assassination, a team of British intelligence and SAS officers involved in the fight against IRA terror came to Tel Aviv to study the tactics of the Israelis. Ari Shamron summoned Gabriel to the academy and compelled him to deliver a luncheon lecture on the Tunis operation. One of the men attending the lecture was an SAS lieutenant. The item that came across the fax machine was a photograph. It had been taken after the luncheon to commemorate the spirit of cooperation between the secret warriors of the two countries. Gabriel, eternally camera shy, wore sunglasses and a sun hat to conceal his identity. The man next to him stared directly into the camera lens. Gabriel carefully examined the face. It was Christopher Keller. Chapter 24. Munich, Zurich. The courier was waiting for Gabriel at the gate in Munich. He had hair the color of caramel and carried a sign that said, "Mr. Kramer, Heller Enterprises." Gabriel followed him through the terminal and across the car park, through blowing snow, until they came to a dark blue Mercedes sedan. "There's a Beretta in the glove box and some brisket on the back seat." "You Bodlim think of everything." "We live to serve." He handed Gabriel the keys. "Bon voyage." Gabriel climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. 10 minutes later, he was speeding along the E-54 motorway back to Zurich. The Swiss are an insular and tribal people, possessing an almost animal instinct to spot outsiders. Anything out of the ordinary is reported to the police, no matter how insignificant. Indeed, the Swiss citizenry is so vigilant that foreign intelligence agencies operating inside the country regard them as a second security service. With this fact in mind, Gabriel was careful to project an image of familiarity as he walked from his car to Augustus Rolf's villa. He thought of an office operation a few years earlier. A team of agents had been sent to Switzerland to bug the flat of a suspected Arab terrorist living in a small town outside Bern. An old lady spotted the team outside the Arab's apartment house and telephoned the police to report a group of suspicious men in her neighborhood. A few minutes later, the team was in custody, and the fiasco was reported around the world. He climbed the slope of the Rosenbühlweg. The familiar silhouette of the Rolf Villa, with its turrets and its towering portico, rose above him. A car passed, leaving two ribbons of black in the fresh snow. He punched in the code to the keyless entry system. The buzzer howled, the deadbolt snapped back. He pushed open the gate and climbed the steps. 2 minutes later, he was inside Rolf's villa. Padding across the dark entrance hall, a small flashlight in one hand, a Beretta in the other. On the second floor corridor, the darkness was absolute. Gabriel moved forward through the pencil-width beam of his flashlight. The study would be on his left, Anna had said, overlooking the street, first door past the bust. Gabriel turned the knob. Locked. But of course. He removed a pair of small metal tools from his coat pocket. God. How long had it been? The academy, 100 years earlier. He had been a green recruit, and Shamron had stood over him the entire time, shouting abuse in his ear.
You have 15 seconds. Your teammates are dead unless you get that door open, Gabriel.
He got down on one knee, slipped the tools into the lock, and went to work, flashlight between his teeth. A moment later, under Gabriel's diligent assault, the old lock gave up the fight. He got to his feet, stepped inside, and closed the door behind him. The room smelled of wood smoke and dog and faintly of tobacco. He lifted the flashlight and played it about the interior. Its tiny pool of light meant that he experienced the room a few square feet at a time. A sitting area furnished with 18th-century armchairs, a Flemish Renaissance oak writing table, bookshelves stretching from a burnished wood floor to a molded ceiling. Augustus Rolf's desk. Strange, but it didn't seem like the desk of a powerful man. There was an air of donnish clutter, a stack of files, a faded leather blotter, a teacup filled with paperclips, a pile of antique books. Gabriel lifted the cover with his index finger, and was greeted by the scent of ancient paper and dust. He turned the light toward the first page. Goethe. As he closed the volume, the light fell upon a large ashtray of cut glass. A dozen cigarette butts lay haphazardly, like spent cartridges, in a bed of ash. He examined the butts more carefully. 2 different brands. Most were Benson and Hedges, but 3 were silk cuts. The old man probably had smoked the Benson and Hedges, but who had smoked the silk cuts? Anna? No, Anna always smoked Gitane. He turned his attention back to the provenance. Anna had said Rolf kept them in the bottom right-hand desk drawer in a file labeled Personal Correspondence. The drawer, like the entrance to Rolf's study, was locked. This time he had a key. He pulled it open and began leafing through the personal papers of Augustus Rolf. He came across a file labeled Maximilian. He took it between his thumb and forefinger, then hesitated. Did he have any right? It felt too much like voyeurism, like peering through a lighted window during an evening walk through a city and seeing a couple quarreling, or an old man sitting alone in front of a television. But what might the file reveal? What sort of things had this man saved about his son? What might Gabriel learn from it about this man, Augustus Rolf? He pulled out the file, laid it across the open drawer, lifted the cover. Photographs, magazine clippings from the sporting pages of European newspapers, tributes from teammates, a long piece from the Zurich newspaper on the cycling accident in the Alps. He was a good man, and I was proud to call him my son. Augustus Rolfe, a prominent Zurich banker, said in a statement issued by his lawyer, I will miss him more than any words could ever express. Crisply folded, meticulously dated and labelled. Augustus Rolfe may have disagreed with his son's chosen profession, Gabriel concluded, but he was a proud father. Gabriel closed the file, slipped it back in its proper place, and resumed the search for personal correspondence. Another file caught his eye. Anna. Again he hesitated, then drew out the file. Inside were childhood photographs of Anna playing the violin, invitations to recitals and concerts, newspaper clippings, reviews of her performances and recordings. He looked more carefully at the photographs. There were definitely two Annas, before the suicide of her mother and after. The difference in her appearance was striking. Gabriel closed the file and slipped it back into the drawer. Time to get back to the business at hand. He flipped through the files until he came to the one marked personal correspondence. He removed it, placed it on Rolfe's desk, and lifted the cover. Letters, some handwritten, some typed on professional stationery. German, French, Italian, English. The linguistic patchwork quilt that is Switzerland. Gabriel leafed through them quickly until he came to the end of the stack. Then he went back to the beginning and repeated the process more slowly. The result was the same. The provenance were gone. As Gabriel played his flashlight beam about the study, he thought of a training drill he had undergone at the academy. An instructor had led him into a room decorated like a hotel suite, handed him a document, and given him a minute to find five suitable hiding places. Had he been given the test in Rolfe's study instead of an ersatz hotel room, he could have come up with 100 places to hide a document. A false floorboard, a large book, beneath a carpet or floorboard, inside a piece of furniture, locked away in a concealed wall safe. And that was only in the study. There were thousands of places in the rambling villa for Rolfe to conceal a sheath of documents. This was a man who had built an underground bunker for his secret art collection. If Rolfe wanted to hide something, the odds of Gabriel finding it were slim. The thought of leaving Zurich empty-handed after so difficult and treacherous a journey was galling to Gabriel. There were two possible explanations for the missing documents. Number one, they had been removed by Rolfe or someone like Werner Müller. Number two, Rolfe had somehow misplaced them. Surely it was possible. He was an old man. Old men make mistakes. Memories fade. File labels become harder to read. Gabriel decided to search the desk thoroughly. There were four file drawers, two on each side, and Gabriel started with the top left. He fell into a monotonous routine. Remove a single file, carefully inspect the contents, replace it, move on to the next. It took Gabriel 30 minutes to search all four drawers. Nothing. He pulled open the center drawer. Pens, pencils, bits of scrap paper, a bottle of glue, a staple remover, a miniature tape recorder. Gabriel picked it up and inspected it with his flashlight. There was no tape inside. He searched the drawer carefully. A tape recorder, no tapes. Odd. He closed the drawer, sat down in Rolfe's chair, and stared at the desk. The center drawer. Something wasn't right. He pulled it open, looked inside, closed it again. Open, close, open, close. The drawer itself was about 4 inches deep, but the storage space was shallower. 2 inches, Gabriel calculated, perhaps even less. He tried to pull the drawer completely out of the desk, but a catch prevented it from coming out. He pulled harder. Same result. He looked at his watch. He had been in the villa 45 minutes, probably longer than was wise. Now he had two choices: walk away or trust his instincts. He stood up, grasped the drawer with both hands, and pulled as hard as he could. The catch gave way, and the drawer tumbled onto the floor, spilling the contents. Gabriel lifted the now empty drawer and turned it over in his hands. Solid, well-crafted, abnormally heavy. He looked carefully at the base. It was quite thick, an inch, perhaps. Walk away, or trust your instincts. There was no neat way to go about it, not if he was going to get his answer quickly. He leaned the drawer against the side of the desk and adjusted the angle. Then he raised his foot and slammed it down. Once, twice, a third time, until the wood began to splinter. The base of the drawer was constructed of not one piece of wood, but two, identical in dimension, one laid atop the other. Between them was a large rectangular envelope, yellow with age, the flap secured with a bit of frayed twine. The provenance? Seemed like an awfully elaborate scheme to conceal provenance. Gabriel separated the shattered bits of wood and held the envelope in his hand. A tremor shook his fingers as he unwound the twine and pried open the flap. He removed the contents, a sheaf of ancient flimsies, and laid them on the desk. He sorted through them carefully, as though he feared they might crumble at his touch. Kronen, pesetas, escudos, pounds. The documents were copies of currency transactions and bank transfers carried out during the war. He looked at the dates. The first of the transactions, a transfer of several thousand Swiss francs to the Union Bank of Stockholm, had occurred in February 1942. The last, a transfer of funds to the Bank of Lisbon, had taken place in June 1944. He set aside the flimsies. The next item was a single sheet of plain white paper with no letterhead. On the left side of the page was a list of names, all German. On the right side was a corresponding list of 12-digit numbers. Gabriel read a few lines. Karl Meyer, 551829651318. Manfred Koenig, 94862846-8948. Josef Fritsch, 26834987-4625. He gathered up the flimsies and lifted the flap of the envelope. He was about to slip the papers inside when he felt something caught in the bottom corner. He reached inside and drew the objects out. A pair of photographs. He looked at the first one. Augustus Rolf, young, handsome, rich, sitting in a restaurant. Judging from the state of the table, a good deal of wine had been consumed. Seated next to him was a fleshy, decadent-looking man in civilian dress, with dueling scars on his cheeks. Gabriel did not recognize him. He turned his attention to the second photograph. The setting was a terrace in an Alpine home. Rolf, standing at the balustrade, admiring the magnificent view, accompanied by two men in uniform. Gabriel recognized them both. One was Heinrich Himmler, the other was Adolf Hitler. Gabriel slipped the photographs and the documents back into the envelope. It was legal-sized, too large to fit into a pocket, so he shoved it down the front of his trousers and secured it by zipping his leather jacket. He looked at the desk. Nothing to be done about the drawer. It was broken to bits. He pushed the fragments under the seating compartment with his foot and concealed them with Rolf's chair. The Beretta was lying on Rolf's leather blotter. He dropped it into his pocket and turned to leave. He navigated by the beam of the weak penlight. Once again, he had the sensation of experiencing the room, a fragment at a time, this time in reverse order. With each movement of the light, a new piece of information. The oak writing table, the 18th-century armchairs, a leather ottoman. A man, standing in the doorway, with a gun pointed at Gabriel's heart. Chapter 25. Zurich. Gabriel tossed the flashlight across the room, drew his Beretta, and dropped to the floor. The man in the doorway fired. The gun was silenced, but the muzzle flash was visible in the darkness. The shot ripped through the air over Gabriel's head and shattered the window behind Rolf's desk. Before the man could shoot again, Gabriel rose onto one knee and fired in the direction of the muzzle flash. The shots struck their target. Gabriel knew this because he could hear the rounds tearing through the tissue and shattering bone. He got to his feet and ran forward, firing as he went, the way he had been trained at the academy, the way he had done it so many times before. When he was standing over the man, he reached down, placed the barrel into his ear, and fired one last time. The body convulsed, then went still. Gabriel knelt and searched the dead man's pockets. No billfold, no keys, no money. A Glock 9mm lay on the floor a few feet from the body. Gabriel slipped it into his pocket and went into the corridor. Next to the center stairwell was an alcove, with a set of tall windows overlooking the street. Gabriel looked down and saw two men pounding up the front steps. He ran across the corridor to the windows, overlooking the rear garden. Outside was another man, gun drawn, feet apart, talking on a handheld radio. As Gabriel descended the curving staircase, he ejected the spent cartridge from his Beretta and inserted the backup. He retraced the route Anna had taken the night she showed him the secret vault, through the great dining room, through the kitchen, down the back staircase, through the wine cellar, into the cutting room. He came to a doorway with a window of paned glass that led into the garden. Gabriel pushed open the door a few inches and peered out. The man with the radio and the gun was prowling the snowy terrace. The other team had entered the house. Gabriel could hear the trample of feet on the first floor above him. He stepped outside and trotted across the garden directly toward the man with the gun. In rapid German, he said, "You there, did you see which way that jackass went?" The man looked at him in utter confusion. Gabriel kept moving forward. "What's wrong with you, man? Are you deaf? Answer me!" When the man lifted his radio to his mouth, Gabriel's arm swung up and he started firing. 5 shots, the last into his chest from 3 feet away. Gabriel looked up toward the house. He could see flashlight beams playing over the drawn curtains. Then the curtains parted and a face appeared, a shout, hammering on glass. Gabriel turned and sprinted across the garden until he came to a wall, 7 feet in height, he guessed, with a row of wrought iron spikes across the top. Glancing over his shoulder, he spotted the two men from the house. One was kneeling over the dead man, the other scanning the garden by the beam of a powerful flashlight. Gabriel jumped up and grabbed hold of the metal spikes at the top of the wall. The beam of light fell on him, and someone shouted in German. He pulled himself up, flailing his feet against the wall. A shot struck the stucco, then another. Gabriel could feel sutures tearing in his hands. He threw his leg over the top and tried to drop onto the other side, but his coat had become tangled on a spike, and he dangled there, helplessly, his head exposed, blinded by the flashlight. He twisted his body violently until the spike released him, and he fell into the opposing garden. The envelope slipped through his coat and dropped into the snow. Gabriel scooped it up, shoved it back into his trousers, and started running. A burst of halogen lamplight turned the night electric white. Somewhere an alarm screamed. Gabriel ran along the side of the villa until he reached another wall, this one shielding the villa from the street. He scaled it quickly and dropped onto the other side. He found himself in a narrow street. Lights were coming on in the neighboring villas, the Swiss and their legendary vigilance. As he ran down the street, Ari Shamron's 11th commandment played in his head, "Thou shalt not get caught." He came to the Kralbuhlstrasse, the wide boulevard where he had parked. He sprinted down the gentle curving slope of the street until he spotted his car. He skidded to a stop and came crashing to the pavement. 2 men were peering into the interior with flashlights. As he clambered to his feet, the men trained their flashlights on him. He turned in the opposite direction and headed back up the hill. "Thou shalt do anything to avoid being arrested." He drew the Glock he had taken from the man in the study and kept running. He was beginning to tire. The cold air was searing his lungs, and his mouth tasted of rust and blood. After a few steps, he saw headlights coming down the hill, a big Audi sedan, wheels spinning on the new snow. He glanced over his shoulder down the hill. The 2 men were chasing him on foot. No side streets, no alleys. He was trapped. "Thou shalt shed innocent blood if necessary." The Audi was speeding directly toward him. He stopped running and leveled the Glock in his outstretched hands. When the car fishtailed and slid to a halt a few feet away, he took aim at the silhouette behind the wheel. Before he could fire, the passenger door flew open. "Get in, Gabriel!" Anna Rolf shouted. "Hurry!" She drove with the same intensity with which she played the violin, one hand on the steering wheel, the other gripping the stick shift. Down the Zürichberg, across Limmat, into the quiet streets of the city center. Gabriel took a long look over his shoulder. "You can slow down now." She eased off the gas. "Where did you learn to handle a car like that?"
"I was a Zürich girl with a lot of money. When I wasn't practicing the violin, I was tearing around the Zürichsee in one of my father's cars. I'd wrecked 3 by the time I was 21.
"Congratulations."
"Bitterness doesn't suit you, Gabriel. My cigarettes are in the console. Do me a favor and light one."
Gabriel opened the console and took out the pack of gitane. He lit it with the dashboard lighter. The smoke caught at the back of his throat and he nearly choked. Anna laughed at him.
"Imagine, an Israeli who doesn't smoke."
"What the hell are you doing here?"
"That's all you have to say. If I hadn't shown up, you'd have been arrested."
"No, if you hadn't shown up, I'd be dead. But I still want to know what the hell you're doing here. Did Rami give you permission to leave the villa?"
"I suspect that by now he's probably discovered that I'm not there."
"How did you get away?"
"I went upstairs to my studio to practice. I rolled a tape on a particularly long piece. I suppose you can guess the rest."
"How did you get off the grounds?"
"Carlos told Rami that he was going into the village to do some marketing. I was in the back beneath a blanket."
"It's safe to assume several dozen members of my service are now engaged in a frantic and pointless search for you. That was a very stupid thing to do. How did you get to Zürich?"
"I flew here, of course."
"Directly from Lisbon?"
"Yes."
"How long have you been here?"
"About 2 hours."
"Did you go inside your father's house?" She shook her head. "When I arrived, I saw 2 men waiting outside in a parked car. At first I thought they might be private security. Then I realized something was wrong."
"What did you do?"
"I didn't feel safe waiting in the car, so I drove round the neighborhood, hoping to find you before you tried to go in. I missed you, of course. Then I heard the alarms going off."
"Did you tell anyone you were coming?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. Why?"
"Because it explains a lot of things. It means that the villa is under constant watch. It means that they know we came back here. It means they followed me to Rome. They've been following me ever since."
"What happened inside my father's house?"
When Gabriel had finished, Anna said, "Did you get the provenance at least?"
"They were gone."
"That's not possible."
"Someone must have gotten to them first."
"Did you find anything else?"
"I found a photograph of your father with Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler admiring the view from the Berghof at Berchtesgaden."
"No," Gabriel said. "I didn't find anything else."
"Are you sure about that? You didn't use the opportunity to rifle through any of my father's personal papers?"
Gabriel ignored her. "Did your father smoke?"
"Why does that matter now?"
"Just answer the question, please. Did your father smoke?"
"Yes, my father smoked."
"What kind of cigarettes?"
"Benson and Hedges."
"Did he ever smoke silk cuts?"
"He was very set in his ways."
"What about someone else in the household?"
"Not that I know of. Why do you ask?"
"Because someone was smoking silk cuts in your father's study recently."
They came to the lake. Anna pulled to the side of the street.
"Where are we going?"
"You're going back to Portugal."
"No, I'm not. We do this together or not at all."
She dropped the Audi into gear. Where are we going? Chapter 26. Lyon. Some men might be squeamish about installing a voice-activated taping system in their home. Professor Émile Jacobi was not one of them. His life was his work, and he had little time for anything else, certainly nothing that might cause him any embarrassment if it was captured on audio tape. He received a steady stream of visitors to his flat on the Rue Lanterne, people with unpleasant memories of the past, stories they had heard about the war. Just last week, an old woman had told him about a train that had stopped outside her village in 1944. She and a group of friends were playing in the meadow next to the tracks when they heard moans and scratches coming from the cargo cars. When they moved closer, they saw that there were people on the train, miserable, wretched people begging for food and water. The old woman realized now that the people were Jews, and that her country had allowed the Nazis to use its railways to ship human cargo to the death camps in the east. If Jacobi had tried to document her story by taking handwritten notes, he would have failed to capture it all. If he had placed a tape recorder in front of her, she might have become self-conscious. It had been Jacobi's experience that most elderly were nervous around tape recorders and video cameras, and so they had sat in the cluttered comfort of his flat like old friends, and the old woman had told her story without the distraction of a notebook or a visible tape recorder. Jacobi's secret system had caught every word of it. The professor was listening to a tape now. As usual, the volume was set quite loud. He found it helped to focus his concentration by blocking out the noise from the street and the students who lived in the next flat. The voice emanating from his machine was not that of the old woman. It was the voice of a man, the man who had come the previous day, Gabriel Allon. An amazing story, this tale of Augustus Rolf and his missing collection of paintings. Jacobi had promised the Israeli he would tell no one about their discussion, but when the story broke, as Jacobi knew it eventually would, he would be perfectly positioned to write about it. It would be yet another black eye for Jacobi's mortal enemies, the financial oligarchy of Zurich. His popularity in his native country would sink to new depths. This pleased him. Flushing sewers was dirty work. Émile Jacobi was engrossed in the story now, as he had been the first time he had heard it, so engrossed that he failed to notice the figure who had slipped into his flat, until it was too late. Jacobi opened his mouth to call out for help, but the man smothered his cry with an iron grip. The professor spotted the glint of a knife blade arcing toward him, then felt a searing pain across the base of his throat. The last thing he saw was his killer, picking up the tape player and slipping it into his pocket as he walked out. Chapter 27. Vienna. On the western fringes of Vienna, Gabriel had to grip the wheel tightly to keep his hands from shaking. He had not been back to the city since the night of the bombing, since the night of fire and blood and a thousand lies. He heard a siren and was uncertain whether it was real or just memory, until the blue lights of an ambulance flashed in his mirror. He pulled to the side of the road, his heart hammering against his ribs. He remembered riding with Leah in an ambulance and praying that she would be released from the pain of her burns, no matter what the price. He remembered sitting over the shattered body of his son while, in the next room, the chief of the Austrian Security Service screamed at Ari Shamron for turning central Vienna into a war zone. He pulled back into the traffic. The discipline of driving helped to settle his turbulent emotions. 5 minutes later, in the Stephansdom quarter, he stopped outside a souvenir shop. Anna opened her eyes. "Where are you going?" "Wait here." He went inside and returned to the car 2 minutes later with a plastic shopping bag. He handed it to Anna. She removed both items, a pair of large sunglasses and a baseball hat with Vienna stenciled across the crown. "What am I supposed to do with these?" "Do you remember what happened at the airport in Lisbon the night you showed me your father's missing collection?
It's been a long night, Gabriel. Refresh my memory. A woman stopped you and asked for your autograph. It happens all the time.
My point exactly. Put them on. She placed the sunglasses over her eyes and tucked her hair beneath the hat. She examined her own appearance in the vanity mirror for a moment, then turned to look at him.
How do I look?
Like a famous person trying to hide behind a pair of large sunglasses and a stupid hat, he said wearily. But it will have to do for now. He drove to a hotel on the Weiburggasse, called the Kaiserin Elisabeth, and checked in under the name of Schmidt. They were given a room with floors the color of honey. Anna fell onto the bed, still wearing the hat and glasses. Gabriel went into the bathroom and looked at his face for a long time in the mirror. He lifted his right hand to his nose, smelled gunpowder and fire, and saw the faces of the two men he had killed at the Rolf Villa in Zurich. He ran warm water into the basin, washed his hand and his neck. Suddenly, the bathroom was filled with ghosts, pallid, lifeless men with bullet holes in their faces and their chests. He looked down and found that the basin was filled with their blood. He wiped his hands on a towel, but it was no good. The blood still was there. Then the room began to spin, and he fell to his knees over the toilet. When he returned to the bedroom, Anna's eyes were closed.
"Are you all right?" she murmured.
"I'm going out. Don't go anywhere. Don't open the door for anyone but me."
"You won't be long, will you?"
"Not too long."
"I'll wait up for you,"
she said, drifting closer toward sleep. "Whatever you say." And then she was asleep. Gabriel covered her with a blanket and went out. Downstairs in the lobby, Gabriel told the officious Viennese desk clerk that Frau Schmidt was not to be disturbed. The clerk nodded briskly, as if to give the impression that he would lay down his life to prevent anyone from interrupting Frau Schmidt's rest. Gabriel pushed a few shilling across the counter and went out. He walked in the Stephansplatz, checking his tail for surveillance, storing faces in his memory. Then he entered the cathedral and drifted through the tourists across the nave until he came to a side altar. He looked up at the altarpiece, a depiction of the martyrdom of St. Stephen. Gabriel had completed a restoration of the painting the night Leia's car was bombed. His work had held up well. Only when he cocked his head to create the effect of raked lighting could he tell the difference between his in-painting and the original. He turned and scanned the faces of the people standing behind him. He recognized none of them, but something else struck him. Each one of them was transfixed by the beauty of the altarpiece. At least something good had come of his time in Vienna. He took one last look at the painting, then left the cathedral and headed for the Jewish quarter. Adolf Hitler's barbarous dream of ridding Vienna of its Jews had largely succeeded. Before the war, some 200,000 had lived here, many of them in the warren of streets around the Judenplatz. Now there were but a few thousand left, mainly newer arrivals from the east, and the old Jewish quarter had been transformed into a strip of boutiques, restaurants, and nightclubs. Among Viennese it was known as the Bermuda Triangle. Gabriel walked past the shuttered bars along the Sterngasse, then turned into a winding walkway that ended in a staircase of stone. At the top of the stairs was a heavy, studded door. Next to the door was a small brass plaque. Wartime claims and inquiries, appointments only. He pressed the bell.
"May I help you?"
"I'd like to see Mr. Lavon, please."
"Do you have an appointment?"
"No.
Mr. Lavon doesn't accept unscheduled visitors."
"I'm afraid it's an emergency."
"May I have your name, please?"
"Tell him it's Gabriel Allon. He'll remember me." The room into which Gabriel was shown was classic Viennese in its proportions and furnishings. A high ceiling, a polished wood floor catching the light streaming through the tall windows, bookshelves sagging beneath the weight of countless volumes and files,
Lavon seemed lost in it, but then, disappearing into the background, was Lavon's special gift. At the moment, however, he was balanced precariously atop a library ladder, flipping through the contents of a bulging file, and muttering to himself. The light from the windows cast a greenish glow over him, and it was then Gabriel realized that the glass was bulletproof. Lavon looked up suddenly, tipping his head downward in order to see over the pair of smudged half-moon reading glasses perched at the end of his nose. Cigarette ash dropped into the file. He seemed not to notice, because he closed the file and slipped it back into its slot on the shelf, and smiled.
Gabriel Allon, Shamron's avenging angel. My God, what are you doing here?
He climbed down the ladder like a man with old pains. As always, he seemed to be wearing all his clothing at once. A blue button-down shirt, a beige roll-neck sweater, a cardigan, a floppy herringbone jacket that seemed a size too large. He had shaved carelessly, and wore socks, but no shoes. He held Gabriel's hands and kissed his cheek. How long had it been? 25 years, thought Gabriel. In the lexicon of the Wrath of God operation, Lavon had been an Ayin, a tracker. An archaeologist by training, he had stalked members of Black September, learned their habits, and devised ways of killing them. He had been a brilliant watcher, a chameleon, who could blend into any surroundings. The operation took a terrible physical and psychological toll on all of them, but Gabriel remembered that Lavon had suffered the most. Working alone in the field, exposed to his enemies for long periods of time, he had developed a chronic stomach disorder that stripped 30 pounds from his lean frame. When it was over, Lavon took an assistant professorship at Hebrew University and spent his weekends on digs in the West Bank. Soon he heard other voices. Like Gabriel, he was a child of Holocaust survivors. Searching for ancient relics seemed trivial when there was so much still to be unearthed about the immediate past. He settled in Vienna and put his formidable talents to work in another way, tracking down Nazis and their looted treasure.
So what brings you to Vienna? Business? Pleasure?
Augustus Wolf.
Wolf, the banker.
Lavon lowered his head and glared at Gabriel over his glasses.
Gabriel, you weren't the one who...
He made a gun of his right hand. Gabriel unzipped his jacket, removed the envelope he had taken from Rolf's desk, and handed it to Lavon. Carefully he pried open the flap, as if he were handling a fragment of ancient ceramic, and removed the contents. He glanced at the first photograph, then the second, his face revealing nothing. Then he looked up at Gabriel and smiled.
Well, well, Herr Rolf takes a lovely photograph. Where did you get these, Gabriel?
From the old man's desk, in Zurich.
He held up the sheaf of documents.
And these?
Same place.
Lavon looked at the photographs again.
Fantastic. What do they mean? I need to pull a few files. I'll have the girls get you some coffee and something to eat. We're going to be a while.
They sat across from each other at a rectangular conference table, a stack of files between them. Gabriel wondered about the people who had come before him. Old men, convinced the man in the flat next door was one of their tormentors at Buchenwald. Children trying to pry open a numbered account in Switzerland, where their father had hidden his life savings before being shipped east into the archipelago of death. Lavon picked up one of the photographs. Rolf, seated in a restaurant next to the man with dueling scars on his cheeks, and held it up for Gabriel to see.
Do you recognize this man?
No.
His name is Walter Schellenberg. Brigadeführer SS.
Lavon took the top file from the stack and spread it on the table before him.
Walter Schellenberg was the head of Department 4 of the Reich Security Main Office. Department 4
handled foreign intelligence, which effectively made Schellenberg the international spymaster of the Nazi Party. He was involved in some of the most dramatic intelligence episodes of the war. The Venlo incident, the attempt to kidnap the Duke of Windsor, and the Cicero operation. At Nuremberg, he was convicted of being a member of the SS, but he received a light sentence of just 6 years in prison.
6 years? Why?
Because, during the last months of the war, he arranged for the release of a few Jews from the death camps.
How did he manage that?
He sold them.
So why was the spymaster of the Nazi Party having dinner with Augustus Rolf?
Intelligence services the world over have one thing in common. They all run on money. Even Shamron couldn't survive without money. But when Shamron needs money, he just lays a hand on the shoulder of a rich friend and tells him the story of how he captured Eichmann. Schellenberg had a special problem. His money was no good anywhere outside Germany. He needed a banker in a neutral country who could provide him with hard currency and then transfer that money through a dummy company or some other front to his agents. Schellenberg needed a man like Augustus Rolf.
Levon picked up the documents Gabriel had taken from Rolf's desk.
Take this transaction. £1,500 sterling, wired from the accounts of Pillar Enterprises Limited to the account of a Mr. Ivan Edberg, Enskilda Bank, Stockholm, the 23rd of October, 1943.
Gabriel inspected the document, then slid it back across the table.
Sweden was neutral, of course, and a hotbed of wartime intelligence,
Levon said.
Schellenberg surely had an agent there, if not an entire network. I suspect Mr. Edberg was one of those agents, perhaps the leader and paymaster of the network.
Levon slipped the transfer order back into the pile and removed another. He peered down at it through his reading glasses, squinting from the smoke of the cigarette between his lips.
Another transfer order. £1,000 sterling from the account of Pillar Enterprises Limited to a Mr. Jose Suarez, care of the Bank of Lisbon.
Levon lowered the paper and looked up at Gabriel.
Portugal, like Sweden, was neutral, and Lisbon was an amusement park for spies. Schellenberg operated there himself during the Duke of Windsor affair.
So, Rolf was Schellenberg's secret banker. But how does that explain the photograph of Rolf at Berchtesgaden with Himmler and Hitler?
Levon prepared his next cup of coffee with the reverence of a true Viennese, a precise measure of heavy cream, just enough sugar to remove the bitter edge. Gabriel thought of Levon in a safe flat in Paris, living on mineral water and weak tea, because his ravaged stomach would tolerate nothing else.
Everything changed inside Germany after Stalingrad. Even the true believers knew it was over. The Russians were coming from the east. The invasion from the west was inevitable. Anyone who'd accumulated wealth as a result of the war wanted desperately to hang on to that wealth. And where do you think they turned?
The bankers of Switzerland.
And Augustus Rolf would have been in a unique position to capitalize on the changing tide of the war. Based on these documents, it appears as though he was an important agent of Walter Schellenberg. I suspect the Nazi bigwigs would have held Herr Rolf in very high esteem.
Someone who could be trusted to look after their money.
Their money, their stolen treasures, all of it.
What about the list of names and the account numbers?
I think it's safe to assume that those are German clients. I'll run them through our database and see if they correspond with known members of the SS and the Nazi Party, but I suspect they're pseudonyms. Would there be any other record of the accounts in the bank's files?
Lavon shook his head.
Typically, the real identities of holders of numbered accounts are known only by the top officers of a bank. The more notorious the customer, the fewer people who know the name attached to the account number. If these accounts belong to Nazis, I doubt whether anyone knew about them but Rolf.
If he kept the list after all these years, does it mean the accounts still exist?
I suppose it's possible. It depends a great deal on who owned them. If the holder was able to get out of Germany at the end of the war, then I would doubt the account is still active. But if the holder was arrested by the Allies...
Then it's possible his money and valuables are still in the vault of the Rolf Bank.
Possible, but unlikely.
Lavon gathered up the documents and photographs and slipped them back into the envelope. Then he looked up at Gabriel and said,
I've answered all your questions. Now it's time for you to answer some of mine.
What do you want to know?
Just one thing, actually,
Lavon said, holding the envelope aloft.
I'd like to know what the hell you are doing with the secret files of Augustus Rolf.
Lavon liked nothing better than a good story. It had always been that way. During the Black September operation, he and Gabriel had shared a kinship of the sleepless. Lavon, because of his stomach, Gabriel, because of his conscience. Gabriel thought of him now, an emaciated figure, sitting cross-legged on the floor, asking Gabriel what it felt like to kill. And Gabriel had told him, because he had needed to tell someone.
There is no God, Lavon had said. There is only Chamron. Chamron decides who shall live and who shall die, and he sends boys like you to wreak his terrible vengeance.
Now, as then, Lavon did not look at Gabriel as he told his story. He stared down at his hands and turned over his cigarette lighter between his nimble little fingers until Gabriel had finished.
Do you have a list of the paintings that were taken from the secret vault?
I do, but I'm not sure how accurate it is.
There's a man in New York. He's dedicated his life to the subject of Nazi art looting. He knows the contents of every stolen collection, every transaction, every piece that's been recovered, every piece that's still missing. If anyone knows anything about the collecting habits of Augustus Rolf, it's him.
This book is continued on Disc 6.